Finish your year with your dream kitchen with help from Menards. Clearview Cabinetry offers a selection of finishes made with the finest materials and built to withstand life's sticky messes. They provide features like soft closed doors and drawers and cabinet accessories to match your unique style. Don't wait to finish your projects. Save big money on Clearview Cabinets and check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening now. Save big money at
Hey y'all, welcome to the first episode of a series I'm doing called How to Train Your Population. This series has one commonality, and that is that it will attempt to explore different ways in which the government tries to control the population that may not seem obvious at first glance, but I will do my best to connect the dots. This series will be more food for thought than absolute fact because it will contain quite a bit of speculation on my end, but I will do my best to provide evidence when applicable. And I also use the term series kind of loosely here because, unlike the Great Debate series, this does not cover one single event. It is an analysis of the current political landscape that covers many factors, and so I will be releasing them kind of off and on as I come up with enough material to do each topic justice. So, with all of that out of the way, this episode is called How to Train Your Population Part 1, The War on Money. Let's get started. So, there's been a war on money at least since the early 20th century, although I would argue before that, because before the Federal Reserve, before income tax, before all of that, a lot of the government's revenue came from tariffs. Now, the problem with tariffs is, one, they discourage free trade, and two, what usually ends up happening is that those who rely more on trade have to pay more of the tariffs, so they disproportionately affect different communities because the communities that have manufacturing and can purchase the goods that are manufactured in that community don't have to import those goods from other countries. And yes, the point of a tariff is meant to encourage domestic consumption rather than importation of foreign goods, but what you end up doing is just creating not only higher prices for consumers that need manufactured goods and other imports, but also you end up discouraging free trade. And trade has been an important part of human cultural development from ancient times onward. I could do a whole episode on that, but I'm just putting that out there. However, I would put the more definite start date of the war on money to about 1913, because two things happened in 1913. First, according to the IRS website, February of that year was when the first federal income tax was. And income tax is, well, tax on income. The problem with a tax on income is it punishes success because those who have income pay it, and those who don't have an income do not pay it. Shouldn't even have to explain this, but that's the essential nature of income tax. And so it punishes success because if you don't work or have a business or collect rent from properties you own, which in order to own properties, unless you were independently wealthy, you generally had to buy them at some point, and you had to make income from something else to afford that. And if you were independently wealthy, then somebody at some point in the past in your family generally had to do the same. So, yeah, income tax basically punishes success. And that's what I mean by a war on money, is there is a war on money in terms of a war on money that is earned through honest means. Also in 1913, the Federal Reserve was founded. And the Federal Reserve is a disaster and has been ever since it's been founded. Because when you have central bureaucrats manage the economy, all you do is cause problems. Because even if you put the brightest economic luminaries in charge of something like the Federal Reserve, you will always end up with a disaster. Because the way markets work best is when a lot of different actors help to determine the prices and the interest rates and all of that. That could also be a topic for another day. But economics is a very complex thing, and when you try to simplify it by having somebody at the top sitting there figuring out what interest rates will be and how much inflation we should aim for, so to speak, that one person will never be smart enough to be able to successfully manage the market as well as millions of different actors can. And generally, the people that we put in this position are not the brightest economic luminaries. They're not the economic Albert Einsteins. So, yeah. It was never designed to work well. But then again, nothing in government works well. All you have to do is drive on a road to learn that. So, the other problem that you have with the Federal Reserve is when you decide how much inflation to aim for each year, you are essentially slowly bleeding the currency dry, because you're saying, for example, right now it's 2% inflation that they go for. What that means when you really think about it is that every 50 years, the currency will inflate 100%, and that's if you stay on target. And oftentimes, it's above the target. So, what you end up doing is causing the currency to be devalued much faster than it probably would naturally. And not only that, but when you don't have the currency backed by anything, it's called fiat currency. And as I covered in the healthcare episode, fiat currency is always a recipe for disaster, because when money is not backed by anything and the government can just print more money whenever it's running low on funds, well, that also helps to inflate and devalue the currency. So I will get to that a bit later. Then the next step that happened in the war on money was the Great Depression happened. Now, I have a theory on the Great Depression that might be a bit unorthodox. I think that the government purposely crashed the stock market because they wanted the New Deal all along. And so they knew if they caused a big depression, that people would become desperate, and if people are desperate enough, they'll sign on to anything to avoid starving to death. So it would not surprise me if the government purposely crashed the stock market in 1929. And the reason I say that is because it's just too convenient, because what you ended up with, among other things, is you ended up with Social Security, and the Social Security program has always been a giant Ponzi scheme. When you pay into it, it's not like a savings account. You don't exactly get what you paid in. That's a common myth, is that you pay in and you get what you paid in when you retire. No, you don't. For one thing, your money specifically is not held on to in like a savings account like it would be in a bank. Two, the inflation especially when the Federal Reserve is managing it, will be so great by the time you retire, if you start paying into it in your 20s, that the amount you will pay in will not be the same amount you get out, even if they give you the exact same amount adjusted for inflation. It will not be worth the same. It will not get you the same amount. And as I just pointed out, you don't get the same amount you put in. And that brings me to another problem with Social Security is not only are you being paid back with other people's money, which is a textbook Ponzi scheme, also Social Security is one of the biggest debt-heavy or debt-causing programs that we have. Right now, the three biggest debt-causing programs are Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. And interest on the debt is also getting up there. And when you continue to just kick this can down the road, you're eventually going to cause, you know, if the U.S. can't make the payments, it's going to default eventually. And we've seen what that does in other countries. And in a country as big as the U.S., you can only imagine it will be many times worse than in a place like Greece. And the third problem with Social Security is the government should not be able to force you to save money. You should save money. I'm not saying you shouldn't save money. In fact, the government doesn't want you to save money, as I'll get to here in a moment, especially if you rely on them for anything. But you can't force somebody to save money. You always hear old fables about like a squirrel and I can't remember what the other animal is, but it's like the squirrel saves acorns for the winter and he survives the winter, and then the other animal doesn't store up for the winter and he starves or he begs for help from the squirrel. It's different versions of the story. But the point is that if you force somebody to save money, I mean, that's unconstitutional. And like, if the person did save money, they shouldn't then have to bail out somebody who did not. So that's my problems with Social Security. And then I have another problem with Social Security disability, because the problem with that and other programs is they essentially keep you trapped in poverty because they have these asset limits. And you can understand the point of an asset limit in theory is that that's the government's way of trying to figure out who's actually in need and who's not, although it's far from perfect. But an asset limit restricts people's ability to save. It would be one thing if there was a program that was designed to help people who were in poverty and to help them get out of poverty. But when you keep people to where they have to stick to a certain asset limit and that prohibits them from saving money, then it's really hard for them to get out of poverty. Not that I think the government should be bailing people out anyway. I think that there should be private charities that do that. And the reason why is because when you force somebody to give to anything, it's not true generosity. True generosity is when I decide I want to give you this much. Like if I make a pledge to the church and I say I'm going to give $20 to the church for whatever they're doing. Or if I see a guy on the street and I say I'm going to give you 10 bucks. Those are voluntary actions. I am voluntarily giving you money. Nobody's forcing me to. There's no reason why I can't choose to not give you money. But when the government forces you to give, to say that you're giving in that situation is generous is like saying that if a guy comes up to you with a gun to your head and says, give me all your money, that giving him all your money would be a generous act. It would not be. It would be an act of self-preservation that I'm sure many, if not most of us, would take, because there's a gun to our head in this situation. And that's basically what happens with the government, because if you don't pay your taxes, they can use any number of legal actions against you. They can put liens on you, they can fine you, they can jail you, they can garnish your wages. So you are forced to give to whatever they choose to use your tax dollars for. A lot of times it's even just taken out of your paycheck, so you never even really see it. Unless you get a tax return. And so there's that. And I know the Bible says, you know, give to Caesar what is Caesar's. And yes, that's true. Every functioning society has to have some level of taxation, but it should be much lower than it is now. I don't know an exact number because I'm not an economist, but I think it should be much, much lower than it is now, and I think most things should be returned to the states, and even in the states, they should figure out what can be privatized or what can be returned to more local jurisdictions and what has to remain at the central, like, state level. I think things should be much more decentralized than they are now in general. So the idea that give to Caesar what is Caesar's is an invitation to allow yourself to just be taxed ad infinitum and say absolutely nothing about it. I don't think that's quite right. Especially because in Psalms, for example, it often criticizes those who take advantage of the poor and exploit the poor. And that's essentially what a government does when they tax you into oblivion. When they tax you into next week, they are taking advantage of you if you are poor, and they're technically taking advantage of you if you're not. Which brings me to another point, that right now we have had a lot of people on the left in the last few years, and I'm sure longer than that, but I started really hearing about it in like 2019. People on the left were saying, tax the rich, eat the rich. And like when I was on the left, I remember encountering this quite a lot. And there are a few major problems with this. First, they can't seem to define the word rich. It's not like, as I mentioned in my Misconceptions on Inflation episode, it's not like, oh, if you have $1 million, you're rich, but if you have $999,999, you're not rich. The term rich is subjective, and I think they leave it purposely subjective so that they can keep broadening it out. I mean, when the income tax was first introduced, it only applied to a pretty small number of people, but now pretty much anybody who works in any form has to pay the income tax, even if they get a return later on. They're still paying the tax. So the idea that, for example, the current proposal to tax unrealized capital gains would only affect those who make more than, $400 million a year would be affected. Even if they were the only ones affected, it would still be a bad policy. But the idea, if you believe that they're going to be the only ones affected if this policy is implemented, then, my friend, I have oceanfront condos in Nebraska to sell you for $10. Because you better believe that anytime the government seizes any new power, they always find ways to expand it. If it's supposed to be something temporary, then the need always seems to either morph and change or expand or never end. And if it's something that only applies to a few, they find some way to make it apply to many. As I've written and said before, government is the crappy house guest that never leaves. And then they also now are not only denying the things that have led to the current inflation, but are also pushing for more policies that will cause more inflation. What do I mean by this? Well, in 2020, because of the quote-unquote COVID pandemic, people were being paid more not to work than they were being paid to work. And that led to a lot of people staying home much longer than they should have. I don't think there should have been any lockdowns. I think we should have just proceeded as normal. But we didn't. And then the government handed out, like, I think there were 2 or 3 rounds of stimulus. And all of this money being just pumped into the economy, as well as people being locked in their homes, figuratively, I guess, literally in China, but figuratively here, and buying a bunch of stuff online, which caused more money to circulate. Those two factors combined led to a lot of the inflation we're seeing now. And then the left is wanting to implement even more inflation if they get reelected. I mean, they've already tried to implement student loan forgiveness, and they're wanting to do even more of it if they get reelected, as well as to give $25,000 to certain home buyers and to implement price controls and all that. And I've mentioned my thoughts on some of those in the misconceptions about inflation episode. But I do want to highlight why I think student loan forgiveness is a problem, because the war on money, as I said, refers to a war on money that is gotten through successful behavior, success, honest means. And so I think student loan forgiveness is part of that war, because it also, not only does it give, essentially give a bailout to a lot of people who took on debt for degrees that many of them don't use, but it also, and like incentivize poor financial planning and behavior, but it also penalizes those who have gone out and have paid back their loans, or who never took out those loans, for a myriad of reasons, and have been successful. It punishes them by making them have to pay back debt that they didn't take out. And some of them didn't take out the debt, like didn't go to school because they didn't want the debt. Like, they made that calculation ahead of time and decided, nope, it's not worth it. And so when I say success, I don't even just mean in terms of dollars and cents. I mean making decisions financially that help you in the long run. Like, as I mentioned earlier, the idea of like saving up to buy real estate or invest some of your money in real estate or whatever, in the hopes that you will make more income off of it by renting it out or building something on it that produces some kind of value. And so now that I've mentioned all of the modern stuff, for the most part, I want to back up a bit, because I don't think the Great Depression and the Federal Reserve and income tax were the only means that the government has declared war on money. A few decades later, in the 60s, you had the Great Society. The Great Society was pitched as a welfare plan to help out the poor and to eradicate poverty, was the pitch. It was eradicate poverty. Well, it didn't actually do that. Poor people still exist, especially in inner cities. And what the Great Society ended up doing is it essentially incentivized single motherhood, because you could get more money as a single mom collecting welfare than you could with a dad working and maybe a mom working, but maybe not. But either way, both parents staying together with the kids. And so that has led to part of the war on the family, which I will probably cover at some point later on. But it has also led to incentivizing detrimental decisions. And that's the same issue I have with student loan forgiveness, because they say it'll be a one-time thing, but you know the government, nothing's ever a one-time thing with them. And so if you keep forgiving the loans, universities will raise the prices of the tuition by however much you forgive or however much you subsidize. And not only that, but people will continue to take out the loans because they'll believe that at some point down the line, could be decades, years down the road, the loans will be forgiven. And that's the same thing here. People have made the calculation that, oh, if I go on these benefits after I, you know, get divorced, or if I never get married and I have these kids and I get these benefits, I'll make more than I would having dad around. And so a lot of people have made that calculation, which is detrimental to the kids and spiritually detrimental to the moms and the dads down the road. So then there's that. And then also I think that two current manifestations actually of the war on money deal with technology. You have the war on cash that is unfolding. I mean, granted, I will grant it's more of a battle. It's not as much of a war right now because, for the most part, talks of creating a central currency have mostly fizzled out, as far as I can tell. There was talk, and it would always be a fear if the left won that they might try it again, but for the time being, they don't seem to be too gung-ho about it. But if they did that, that would definitely be a war on money, because it would make everybody dependent on the government, and it would lead everybody to suffer from the same issue that people on benefits suffer from. If you are dependent on the government, if you are dependent on that spigot, you know, whether you consciously acknowledge it or not, you know that the government can always turn off that spigot. The government can always turn off that spigot, and you will no longer have the benefits if you step too far out of line. Nobody wants to say it right now, and right now I don't think they would, but when a government has that much power over you, they always could. And we're already seeing in other countries things like debanking. Nigel Farage got debanked, and a lot of other people are getting debanked in, like, the UK, for instance. And so if you are encouraging people to go on these benefits and be dependent, you've created these dependents and you have power over them, because if you turn off that spigot, they won't be able to feed their families anymore. Not that they were living on a princely sum to begin with, but at least they were getting by. And if you get rid of cash and you put everybody on a central bank digital currency, you make everybody into those government dependents. Because if you have control, if you as the government have control over a currency, you can freeze people's accounts, you can control how much they can spend, you can control what they can spend it on. If they can't take out cash anymore, then that prevents them from having that workaround, even if the banks are tied to the government more than they are already. We're already seeing something similar in China. In China, there's like social credit scores, and people can be excluded from a lot of everyday activities if they do a lot of things that aren't necessarily written into the law as being illegal, but that the government doesn't like. So, yeah, a central bank digital currency would be a disaster. And it would be a big victory on the left in the war on money, and a big defeat for those of us who actually want to have liberty and not be controlled by the government that I wouldn't trust a slice of pizza at this point. And then another modern incarnation of this war on money is the increased push by big tech and the government towards AI. I think big tech is more leading this than the government, but like, when you push people to adopt AI, knowing full well that AI will kill jobs, if less people can be employed, then that means more people will likely end up as government dependents, which means more people relying on that spigot. And also, it's a war on success, because if you can't get a job, then you can't be successful in the working world. First step to being successful in the working world, obviously, is being in the working world. That's not a guarantee for success. I am not in favor of participation trophies, but it's like those who don't show up will never be successful. And I think, too, that that's another problem we've had with things like the minimum wage. When you impose a minimum wage and you tell employers this is how much you have to pay, it has good intentions. Workers are human too, but what you end up doing, especially when you raise that minimum wage, is you not only cause higher prices because those higher wage costs will be passed on to the consumers, but you also price people out of the market. And if people cannot get the jobs because the employers are not hiring because they have to cut down on how many people they hire, then those people no longer get those jobs. It's especially crucial with teenagers that they can get jobs that will give them a head start in the working world, because many people's first jobs happen when they're in their teens. And so there's that. And we especially saw that when California decided to raise their minimum wage to $20 an hour. And then all of a sudden people were surprised that employers were cutting hours and laying people off. It's like, no duh. What did you think would happen? But yeah, that's a war on success, because you're pricing people out of the market and therefore shutting the gate for those people to be successful. And so, to recap, there is a war on money that's been going on for at least 100 years. Probably a little bit more. I briefly mentioned the problems with tariffs, because tariffs were a big thing. And they're still around today, but they were a really big thing back in the 1800s. I briefly mentioned them, but I think the war on money intensified in 1913 with the establishment of the income tax and the founding of the Federal Reserve. I mentioned my theory on the Great Depression, that I'm pretty sure the government purposely crashed the stock market, because the results that came from the Depression were too politically convenient for it not to be their work. And one of those results, the biggest one that still lingers today, although there are others, but the biggest one that lingers today is Social Security. And I mentioned that there are several problems with Social Security, one being that it's a Ponzi scheme, two, that it essentially tries to force people to save money, and doesn't even really accomplish that, because you're not actually getting the same amount you're getting paid. Like, at least in some Ponzi schemes, you at least at first start to get the same amount you put in, or the high returns that are promised. But in Social Security, you pay into it, but you get a much lower amount back. And it's somebody else's money. Also, even if the government was giving you back the same amount, dollar for dollar, or adjusted for inflation, either way, it would still be a problem, because the government cannot and should not, or at least should not, be able to force you to save money. Saving money is something that is, it's good, you should do it, but it should be on you. You should be the one to save the money. Shouldn't be the government setting it aside for you and trusting and having you trust them to manage it, because all you have to do is drive on roads for any length of time to see that the government's not efficient. Or interact with the BMV in any significant way. Or fill out your taxes. Those are all easy ways to see that the government is not efficient. And then another problem is with a lot of welfare programs, and specifically too with Social Security disability, is that it prevents you from saving money, or penalizes you for doing so, because it has an asset cap, and that asset cap essentially keeps people trapped in poverty. And even if a government program could effectively lift people out of poverty, that should not be the government's job, but it would at least be more understandable if it actually did that. You could at least make the case that it was like a necessary evil or something. Although, as I said, it doesn't do that. And the Great Society doesn't do that either. It just incentivizes broken families. And then I also mentioned the problems with things like minimum wages, handouts for student loan forgiveness and other things, stimulus, the push for central bank currencies and AI, the problems with taxing the rich because nobody can seem to define what the rich is, and they also can't seem to agree on, like, exactly how much to tax them. And, like, even if you could agree on those things, it would still be a problem. I didn't mention this earlier, but it would still be a problem because if you tax the rich too much, they will leave, one. And two, taxing the rich discourages future ambition. So it is part of a war on success in that way, because if somebody knows, hey, if I get rich from this business or whatever, then I'm gonna get taxed for it. I'm gonna get taxed into oblivion. So that will discourage future, like, ambition and will damage the economy. So there's that. And so with all of that said, I hope you've enjoyed this episode, or at least become a bit more informed or had your eyes opened by it. Thank you so much for listening. Feel free to come back next time. You can find us on Spotify, Amazon Music, and the RSS feed. And have a blessed day.